Ricochet. Sergeant Kojo Asante watches his fucking step. He watches it when he goes up against airheads and realists. He watches it when pitted against well-funded private armies running on profit and ideology, against ragged makeshift ones driven by thirst and desperation, against rogue Darwin banks and the inevitable religious extremists who, almost a quarter century after the end of the Dark Decade, still haven't stopped maiming and killing in the name of their invisible friends. His steps don't really falter until 21 months into his tour, when he kills 3 unarmed children off the coast of Honduras. Zero S has risen from the depths of the Atlantic to storm one of the countless islands that ride the major currents of the world's oceans. Some are refugee camps with thousands of inhabitants. Others serve as havens for hustlers and tax dodgers eager to avoid the constraints of more stationary jurisdictions. Some are military, sheathed in chromatophores and radar-damping nanotubes, bigger than airports, invisible to man or machine. The Cazador de Recompensa is a fish farm, a family business registered out of Brazil. 2 modest hectares of low-slung superstructure on a donut hull with a cluster of net pens at its center. It is currently occupied by forces loyal to the latest incarnation of Shining Path. The path thrives on supply lines with no fixed address, and as Metzinger reminded them on the way down, it's always better to prevent a fight than win one. If the path can't feed their troops, maybe they won't deploy them. This is almost a mission of mercy. Asante eavesdrops on the sounds of battle, takes in a mingled reek of oil and salt air and rotten fish, lets Evil Twin's world view wash across his eyes in a blur of light and the incomprehensible flicker of readouts with millisecond lifespans. Except during target acquisition, of course. Except for those brief stroboscopic instants when E.T. locks on and faces freeze and blur in turn. A couple of coveralled S-Asian men wielding heckler cokes. A wounded antique Janlu staggering on 2.5 legs, the beam from its mad gun wobbling wide of any conceivable target. Children in life jackets, 2 boys, 1 girl. Asante guesses their ages at between 7 and 10. Each time the weapon kicks in his hands, and an instant later, E.T. is veering toward the next kill. Emotions are sluggish things in passenger mode. He feels nothing in the moment, shock in the aftermath, horror still halfway to the horizon when a random ricochet slaps him back into the driver's seat. The bullet doesn't penetrate, not much punches through the chrysomelan armor wrapped tight around his skin, but vectors interact. Momentum passes from a small, fast object to a large, slow one. Asante's brain lurches in its cavity. Meat slaps bone and bounces back. Deep in all that stressed gray matter, some vital circuit shorts out. There's pain, of course, blooming across the side of his head like napalm in those few seconds before his endocrine pumps damp it down. There's fire in the bud, a blaze of static, and a crimson icon warning of Z-mode failure. But there's a little miracle, too. Kojo Asante can see again. A high sun in a hard blue sky. A flat, far horizon. Columns of oily smoke rising from wrecked machinery. Bodies. The air cracks a few centimeters to his right. He drops instinctively to a deck slippery with blood and silver scales, gags at the sudden stench wafting from a slurry of bloated carcasses crowding the surface of the holding pen just in front of him.
Coho Atlantic hybrids,
he notes despite himself.
Might even have those new shawl jeans.
A turret on treads sparks and sizzles on the other side, a hole blown in its carapace. A shadow blurs across Asante's forearm. Tijuana leaps across the sky, diffractors high on her forehead, eyeballs dancing madly in their sockets. She clears the enclosure, alights graceful as a dragonfly on 1 foot, kicks the spastic turret with the other. It sparks 1 last time and topples into the pen. Tijuana vanishes down the nearest companionway. Asante gets to his feet, pans for threats, sees nothing but enemies laid waste. The smoking stumps of perimeter auto turrets, the fallen bodies of a man with his arm blown off, and a woman groping for a spear gun just beyond reach. and a small, brittle figure almost fused to the deck. Blackened sticks for arms and legs, white teeth grinning in a charred skull. A bright, half-melted puddle of orange fabric and PVC holding it all together. Asante sees it all, not just snapshots glimpsed through the fog. Zero-S handiwork, served up for the first time in 360 wraparound immersion.
We're killing children.
Even the adult bodies don't look like combatants. Refugees, maybe, driven to take by force what they couldn't get any other way. Maybe all they wanted was to get somewhere safe, to feed their kids. At his feet, a reeking carpet of dead salmon converge listlessly in the wake of the fallen turret. They aren't feeding anything but hagfish and maggots.
I have become a Sahelite,
Asante reflects numbly. He calls up Bud, ignores the unreadable auras flickering around the edges of vision, selects GPS. Not off Honduras. They're in the Gulf of Mexico. No one in their right mind would run a fish farm here. The best parts of the Gulf are anoxic. The worst are downright flammable. Casado must have drifted up through the Yucatan Channel, got caught in an eddy loop. All these fishes would have suffocated as soon as they hit the dead zone. But Guylands aren't entirely at the mercy of the currents. They carry rudimentary propulsion systems for docking and launching, switching streams and changing course. Casado's presence so deep in the Gulf implies either catastrophic equipment failure or catastrophic ignorance. Asante can check out the first possibility anyway. He stumbles toward the nearest companionway. Estevana and Acosta burst onto deck from below. Acosta seizes his right arm, Tijuana his left. Neither slows. Asante's feet bounce and drag. The lurching acceleration reawakens the pain in his temple. He cries out,
"The engines!"
New pain, other side, sharp and recurrent. An ancient weight belt swinging back and forth across Acosta's torso, a frayed strip of nylon threaded through an assortment of lead slugs. It's like being hammered by a tiny wrecking ball. One part of Asante wonders where Acosta found it. Another watches Garen race into view with a small, bloody body slung across his shoulder. Garen passes one of the dismembered turrets, grabs a piece with his free hand, and keeps running. Everyone's charging for the rails. Tijuana's mouthpiece is in, her diffractors down. She empties a clip into the deck ahead, right at the water's edge. Gunfire shreds plastic and whitewashed fiberglass, loosens an old iron docking cleat. She dips and grabs in passing, draws it to her chest, never loosening her grip on Asante. He hears the soft pop of a bone leaving its socket in the instant before they all go over the side. They plummet head first, dragged down by 100 kilograms of improvised ballast. Asante chokes, jams his mouthpiece into place, coughs seawater through the exhaust and sucks in a hot lungful of fresh sparked hydrox. Pressure builds against his eardrums. He swallows, swallows again, manages to keep a few millibars ahead of outright rupture. He has just enough freedom of movement to claw at his face and slide the diffractors over his eyes. The ocean clicks into focus, clear as acid, empty as green glass. Green turns white. Seen in that flash-blinded instant, 4 thin streams of bubbles rising to a surface gone suddenly incandescent. 4 dark bodies falling from the light. A thunderclap rolls through the water, deep, downshifted, as much felt as heard. It comes from nowhere and everywhere. The roof of the ocean is on fire. Some invisible force shreds their contrails from the top down, tears those bubbles into swirling silver confetti. The wavefront races implacably after them. The ocean bulges, recoils. It squeezes Asante like a fist, stretches him like rubber. Tijuana and Acosta tumble away in the backwash. He flails, stabilizes himself as the first jagged shapes resolve overhead. Dismembered chunks of the booby-trapped Guyland tumbling with slow majesty into the depths. A broken wedge of deck and stairwell passes by a few meters away, tangled in monofilament. 1,000 glassy eyes stare back from the netting as the wreckage fades to black. Asante scans the ocean for that 5th bubble trail. The last dark figure to balance those who left against those who returned. No one overhead. Below, a dim shape that has to be Grain shares its mouthpiece with the small limp thing in his arms. Beyond that, the hint of a deeper dark against the abyss, a shark-like silhouette keeping station amid a slow rain of debris, waiting to take its prodigal children home again. They're too close to shore. There might be witnesses. So much for stealth ops. So much for low profiles and no questions asked. Metzinger's going to be pissed. Then again, they are in the Gulf of Mexico. Any witnesses will probably just think it caught fire again. Lady Grinning Soul. In your own words, Sergeant, take your time. We kill children. We kill children. And we lost Silano. And I don't know why. And I don't know if you do either, he thought. But of course, that would involve taking Major Emma Rossiter at her word. Did the child? Metzinger had already tubed Garin's prize by the time Asante reboarded the sub. Garin, of course, had no idea what his body had been doing. Metzinger had not encouraged discussion. That was okay. Nobody was really in the mood anyhow.
I'm sorry. She didn't make it.
Rossiter waits for what she probably regards as a respectful moment.
If we could focus on the subject at hand. It was a shitstorm,
Asante says.
Sir. We gathered that.
The Major musters a sympathetic smile.
We were hoping you could provide more in the way of details. You must have the logs. Those are numbers, Sergeant. Pixels. You are uniquely, if accidentally, in a position to give us more than that. I never even got below decks.
Rossiter seems to relax a little.
Still, this is the first time one of you has been debooted in mid-game, and it's obviously not the kind of thing we want to risk repeating. Maddox is already working on ways to make the toggle more robust. In the meantime, your perspective could be useful in helping to ensure this doesn't happen again. My perspective, sir, is that those forces did not warrant our particular skill set. We are more interested in your experiences regarding the deboot, Sergeant. Was there a sense of disorientation, for example? Any visual artifacts in Bud?
Asante stands with his hands behind his back, good gripping bad, and says nothing.
Very well.
Rossiter's smile turns grim.
Let's talk about your perspective, then. Do you think regular forces would have been sufficient? Do you have a sense of the potential losses incurred if we'd sent, say, West Ham Marines?
They appeared to be refugees, sir. They didn't pose.
100%, Sergeant. We would have lost everyone.
Asante says nothing.
Unarmed soldiers wouldn't even have made it off the Gyland before it went up. Even if they had, the P-wave would have been fatal if you hadn't greatly increased your rate of descent. Do you think regular forces would have made that call? Seen what was coming? Run the numbers? Improvised a strategy to get below the kill zone in less time than it would take to shout a command?
We killed children.
It's barely more than a whisper. Collateral damage is an unfortunate, but inevitable.
We targeted children.
Ah.
Rossiter plays with her tackpad. Tap, 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 swipe.
These children, she says at last. Were they armed?
I do not believe so, sir.
Were they naked?
Sir?
Could you be certain they weren't carrying concealed weapons? Maybe even a remote trigger for 1,000 kilograms of CL-20?
They were, sir. They couldn't have been more than 7 or 8.
I shouldn't have to tell you about child soldiers, Sergeant. They've been a fact of life for centuries, especially in your particular. At any rate, just out of interest, how young would someone have to be before you'd rule them out as a potential threat?
I don't know, sir.
Yes, you do. You did. That's why you targeted them.
That wasn't me.
Of course, it was your evil twin. That's what you called it, right?
Rossiter leans forward.
Listen to me very carefully, Sergeant Asante, because I think you're laboring under some serious misapprehensions about what we do here. Your twin is not evil, and it is not gratuitous. It is you, a much bigger part of you than the whiny bitch standing in front of me right now.
Asante clenches his teeth and keeps his mouth shut.
This gut feeling giving you so much trouble, this sense of right and wrong, where do you think it comes from, Sergeant?
Experience, sir.
It's the result of a calculation. A whole series of calculations, far too complex to fit into the conscious workspace. So the subconscious sends you an executive summary, you might call it. Your evil twin knows all about your sense of moral outrage. It's the source of it. It has more information than you do, processes it more effectively. Maybe you should trust it to know what it's doing.
He doesn't. He doesn't trust her, either. But suddenly, surprisingly, he understands her. She's not just making a point. This isn't just rhetoric. The insight appears fully formed in his mind, a bright shard of unexpected clarity. She thought it would be easy. She really doesn't know what happened. He watches her fingers move on the pad as she speaks, notes the nervous flicker of her tongue at the corner of her mouth. She glances up to meet his eye, glances away again. She's scared. Look back in anger. Asante awakens standing in the meadow up the mountain. The sky is cloudless and full of stars. His fatigues are damp with sweat or dew. There is no moon. Black conifers loom on all sides. To the east, a hint of pre-dawn orange seeps through the branches. He has read that this was once the time of the dawn chorus, when songbirds would call out in ragged symphony to start the day. He has never heard it. He doesn't hear it now. There's no sound in this forest but his own breathing and the snap of a twig under someone's foot. He turns. A gray shape detaches itself from the darkness.
Fellow corpse,
Tijuana says.
Fellow corpse,
he responds.
You wandered off. Thought I'd tag along. Make sure you didn't go AWOL.
I think it is acting up again.
Maybe you're just sleepwalking. People sleepwalk sometimes.
She shrugs.
Probably the same wiring anyway.
Sleepwalkers don't kill people.
Actually, that has been known to happen.
He clears his throat.
No one else knows you're up here.
Did E.T. disable the pickups?
I did.
Thanks.
Anytime.
Asante looks around.
I remember the first time I saw this place. It was magical.
I was thinking more ironic.
Adding at Asante's look,
you know, that one of the last pristine spots in this whole shit show owes its existence to the fact that West Ham needs someplace private to teach us how to blow shit up.
Count on you,
Asante says. The stars are fading. Venus is hanging in there, though.
You've been weird,
she observes,
ever since the thing in Casado.
It was a weird thing.
So I hear.
Shrug.
I guess you had to be there.
He musters a smile.
So you don't remember?
Legs running down, legs running back up. My zombie never targeted anything, so I don't know what she saw.
Metzinger does. Rossiter does.
He leans his ass against a convenient boulder.
Does it even bother you that you don't know what your own eyes are seeing, and they do?
Not really. Just the way it works.
We don't know what we're doing out there. When was the last time Maddox even showed us a highlight reel?
He feels the muscles clenching in his jaw.
We could be war criminals.
There is no we. Not when it matters.
She sits beside him.
Besides, our zombies may be non-conscious, but they're not stupid. They know we're obligated to disobey unlawful commands.
Maybe they know. Not sure Maddox's compliance circuit would let them do anything about it.
Somewhere nearby, a songbird clears its throat. Tijuana takes a breath.
Suppose you're right. Not saying you are, but suppose they sent us out to gun down a guyland full of harmless refugees. Forget that Casador was packing enough explosives to blow up a hamlet. Forget that it killed Silano. Hell, nearly killed us all.
If Metzinger decides to bash in someone's innocent skull, you still don't blame the hammer he used.
And yet, someone's skull is still bashed in.
Across the clearing, another bird answers. The dawn duet.
There must be reasons,
she says, as if trying it on for size. He remembers reasons from another life, on another continent. Retribution. The making of examples. Poor impulse control. Just fun, sometimes.
Such as?
I don't know, okay? Big picture's way above our pay grade, but that doesn't mean you toss out the chain of command every time someone gives you an order without a 20-gig backgrounder to go with it. If you want me to believe we're enthralled to a bunch of fascist baby killers, you're gonna need more than a few glimpses of something you may have seen on a guyland.
How about, I don't know, all of human history?
Venus is gone at last. The rising sun streaks the clearing with gold.
It's the deal we made. Sure, it's a shitty one. Only shittier one is being dead. But would you choose differently, even now? Go back to being fish food?
He honestly doesn't know.
We should be dead, Joe. Every one of these moments is a gift.
He regards her with a kind of wonder.
I never know how you do it.
Do what?
Channel Schopenhauer and Pollyanna at the same time without your head exploding.
She takes his hand for a moment, squeezes briefly, rises.
We're gonna make it. Just so long as we don't rock the boat. All the way to that honorable fucking discharge.
She turns to the light. Sunrise glows across her face.
Until then, in case you were wondering, I've got your back.
There is no you,
he reminds her.
Not when it matters.
I've got your back, she says.
Watch that man. They've outsourced Solano's position, brought in someone none of them have ever seen before. Technically, he's one of them, though the scars that tag him 0S have barely had time to heal. Something about him is wrong, something about the way he moves, his insignia, not specialist or corporal or sergeant.
I want you to meet Lieutenant Jim Moore,
Rossiter tells them. 0S finally have a commissioned secco. He's easily the youngest person in the room. He gets right to it.
This is an Anisovic mine.
The SATCAM wall zooms down onto the roof of the world.
Baffin Island, 750 clicks north of the Arctic Circle, heart of the slush belt.
A barren, fractured landscape of red and ochre. Drumlins and hillocks and bifurcating stream beds.
Tapped out at the turn of the century.
A brown road undulating along some scoured valley floor. A cluster of buildings, a gaping mouth in the earth.
These days, people generally stay away on account of its remote location. Also on account of the 8,000 metric tons of high-level nuclear waste the Canadian government brought over from India for deep-time storage. Part of an initiative to diversify the northern economy, apparently.
Tactical schematics now. Processing and intake. Train tracks corkscrewing into the Canadian shield. Storage tanks branching like the streets of an underground subdivision.
Project was abandoned after the Greens lost power in 38. You could poison a lot of cities with this stuff, which may be why someone's messing around there now.
Garen's hand is up.
Someone, sir?
So far, all we have are signs of unauthorized activity and a JTFN drone that went in and never came out. Our first priority is to identify the actors. Depending on what we find, we might take care of it ourselves, or we might call in the bombers. Won't know until we get there.
And we won't know even then.
Asante muses, and realizes in that moment what it is about Moore that strikes him as so strange.
We'll be prepping your better halves with the operational details en route.
It's not what is, it's what isn't. No tick at the corner of the eye, no tremor in the hand. His speech is smooth and perfect, his eyes make contact with steady calm. Lieutenant Moore doesn't glitch.
For now, we anticipate a boots-down window of no more than 7 hours.
Asante looks at Tijuana. Tijuana looks back. Zero S are out of beta. Subterraneans. The Lockheed drops them at the foot of a crumbling pier. Derelict shops and listing trailers, long abandoned, huddle against the sleeting rain. This used to be a seaport, then a West Ham refueling station back before West Ham was even a word. Before the apocalyptic Arctic weather made it easier to just stick everything underwater. It lived its short life as a company town, an appendage of the mine, in the days before Nanisivik was emptied of its valuables and filled up again. Bud says 1505, less than an hour if they want to be on target by sundown. Moore leads them overland across weathered stone and alluvial washouts and glistening, acneed Martian terrain. They're 1,500 meters from the mouth of the repository when he orders them all into the back seat. Asante's legs, under new management, pick up the pace. His vision blurs, at least up here, in the wind and blinding sleet, it doesn't make much difference. A sound drifts past, the roar of some distant animal, perhaps. Nearer, the unmistakable discharge of an Epsilon 40, not ET's. Asante's eyes remain virtuously clouded. The wind dies in the space of a dozen steps, half as many again, and the torrent of icy needles on his face slows to a patter, a drizzle. Asante hears great bolts unlatching, a soft screech of heavy metal. They pass through some portal, and the bright overcast in his eyes dims by half. Buckles and boot steps echo faintly against rock walls. Downhill, a gentle curve to the left. Gravel, patches of broken asphalt. His feet step over unseen obstacles. And stop. The whole squad must have frozen. He can't hear so much as a breath. The super saccadic ticker tape flickering across the fog seems faster. Could be his imagination. Off in some subterranean distance, water. Drip, drip, drips onto a steel surface. Quiet movement as Zero S spreads out. Asante is just a passenger, but he reads the footsteps, feels his legs taking him sideways, kneeling. The padding on his elbows doesn't leave much room for fine-grained tactile feedback, but the surface he's bracing against is flat and rough, like a table sheathed in sandpaper. There's a musky animal smell in the air, from somewhere in the middle distance, a soft waffle. The stirring of something huge and slow, sleepy motion. Maybe someone left the door open, and something got in. Pizzly bears are the only animals that come to mind, monstrous hybrids birthed along the boundaries of stressed ecosystems crashing into each other. He's never seen one in the flesh. A grunt, a low growl, the sound of building speed. Gunshots, a roar deafeningly close, and a clash of metal against metal. The flickering tactical halo dims abruptly, network traffic just dropped by a node. Now the whole network crashes, pawn exchange, Zero-S sacrificing their own LAN as the price of jamming the enemies. Moore's mad gun snaps to the right, an instant of scorching heat as the beam sweeps across Asante's arm, Moore shooting wide, Moore missing. E.T. breaks cover, leaps and locks. For one crystalline millisecond, Asante sees a wall of coarse ivory-brown fur close enough to touch, every follicle in perfect focus. The clouds close in. E.T. pulls the trigger. A bellow. The scrape of great claws against stone. The reek is overpowering, but E.T.'s already pirouetting after fresh game, and click, the freeze-frame glimpse of monstrous ursine jaws and a face wide as a doorway, and click, small brown hands raised against an onrushing foe, and click, a young boy with freckles and strawberry blonde hair, and Asante's blind again, but he feels E.T. pulling on the trigger. Pop, pop, pop.
What the fuck, children? What the fuck? What the fuck?
And E.T.'s changed course again, and click, a small back, a fur coat, black hair flying in the light of the muzzle flash.
Not again, not again. Child soldiers, suicide bombers, for centuries.
But no one's shooting back. He knows the sound of every weapon the squad might use, down to the smallest pop and click, the sizzle of the mad gun, the bark of the Epsilon, Acosta's favorite Olympic. He hears them now, those and no others. Whatever they're shooting at isn't returning fire.
Whatever we're shooting at, you blind, murderous tways! You're shooting eight-year-olds! Again!
More gunfire, still no voices but for a final animal roar that gives way to a wet gurgle and the heavy slap of meat on stone.
It's nuclear waste repository at the North Pole. What are children even doing here? What am I? What am I?
And suddenly he sees the words, all tautologies are tautologies, and E.T.'s back downstairs and the basement door locks, and Kojo Asante grabs frantically for the reins and takes back his life and opens his eyes. In time to see the little freckled boy, dressed in ragged furs, sitting on Riley Guerin's shoulders and dragging a jagged piece of glass across his throat. In time to see him leap free of the body and snatch Guerin's gun, toss it effortlessly across the dimly lit cave to an Asian girl clad only in a filthy loincloth, who's sailing through the air toward a bloodied Jim Moore. In time to see that girl reach behind her and catch the gun in midair without so much as a backward glance. More than a dance, more than teamwork, like digits on the same hand, moving together. The Pizzlies piled up against a derelict forklift, a giant tawny thing raking the air with massive claws even as it bleeds out through the hole in its flank. A S-Asian child with his left hand blown off at the wrist,
maybe that was me,
dips and weaves around the fallen behemoth. He's using it, exploiting the sweep of its claws and teeth as a kind of exclusion zone guaranteed to maul anyone within 3 meters. Somehow those teeth and claws never seemed to connect with him. They've connected with Acosta, though. Carlos Acosta, lover of sunlight and the great outdoors, lies there broken at the middle, staring at nothing. Guerin finally crashes to the ground, blood gushing from his throat.
They're just children, in rags, unarmed.
The girl rebounds between rough-hewn tunnel walls and calcified machinery, lines up the shot with Guerin's weapon. Her bare feet never seem to touch the ground.
They're children. They're just...
Tijuana slams him out of the way as the beam sizzles past. The air shimmers and steams. Asante's head cracks against gears and conduits and ribbed metal, bounces off steel onto rock. Tijuana lands on top of him, eyes twitching in frantic little arcs. And stopping. It's a moment of pure panic, seeing those eyes freeze and focus.
She doesn't know me. She's locking on. She's locking on.
but something shines through from behind and Asante can see that her eyes aren't target-locked at all. They're just looking.
Sofiko!
Whatever happens, I've got your back. But Sofiko's gone. If she was ever even there. Blackout. Moore hands him off to Metzinger. Metzinger regards him without a word, with a look that speaks volumes, flips a switch and drops him into passenger mode. He doesn't tell Asante to stay there. He doesn't have to. Asante feels the glassy pain of a tackpad under E.T.'s hand. That hand rests deathly still for seconds at a time, erupts into a flurry of inhumanly fast taps and swipes, pauses again. Out past the bright blur in Asante's eyes, the occasional cough or murmur is all that punctuates the muted roar of the Lockheed's engines. E.T. is under interrogation. A part of Asante wonders what it's saying about him, but he can't really bring himself to care. He can't believe they're gone. No control.
Sergeant Asante.
Major Rossiter shakes her head.
We had such hopes for you.
Acosta, Guerin, Tijuana.
Nothing to say?
So very much, but all that comes out is the same old lie.
They were just children.
Perhaps we can carve that on the gravestone of your squad mates.
But who?
We don't know. We'd suspect realists if the tech itself wasn't completely antithetical to everything they stand for. If it wasn't way past their abilities.
They were barely even clothed. It was like a nest.
More like a hive, Sergeant. Digits on the same hand.
Not like you, she says, as if reading his mind. Zero-S networking is quite inefficient when you think about it. Multiple minds and multiple heads independently acting on the same information and coming to the same conclusion. Needless duplication of effort.
And these?
Multiple heads. One mind.
We jammed the freaks. Even if they were networked, we don't think they work like that.
Best guess is, bioradio, you could call it.
Like a quantum-entangled corpus callosum.
She snorts.
Of course, at this point, they could say it was elves, and I'd have to take their word for it.
Casador,
Asante remembers. They've learned a lot from one small, stolen corpse.
Why use children?
He whispers.
Oh, Gojo.
Asante blinks at the lapse. Rossiter doesn't seem to notice.
Using children is the last thing they want to do. Why do you think they've been stashed in the middle of the ocean or down some Arctic mineshaft? We're not talking about implants. This is genetic. They were born. They have to be protected, hidden away until they grow up and ripen.
Protected? By abandoning them in a nuclear waste site?
Abandoning them, yes, completely defenseless, as you saw.
When he says nothing, she continues.
It's actually a perfect spot. No neighbors, lots of waste heat to keep you warm, run your greenhouses, mask your heat print, no supply lines for some noisy satellite to notice, no telltale EM. From what we can tell, there weren't even any adults on the premises. They just lived off the land, so to speak. Not even any weapons of their own, or at least they didn't use any. Used bears, of all things. Used your own guns against you. Maybe they're minimalists. Value improvisation.
She sacks something onto her pad.
Maybe they just want to keep us guessing.
Children.
He can't seem to stop saying it.
For now.
Wait till they hit puberty. Rossiter sighs.
We bombed the site, of course, slagged the entrance.
If any of ours were trapped down there, they wouldn't be getting out. Then again, we're not talking about us, are we? We're talking about a single distributed organism with God knows how many times the computational mass of a normal human brain. I'd be very surprised if it couldn't anticipate and counter anything we planned. Still, we do what we can. Neither speaks for a few moments. And I'm sorry, Sergeant, she says finally. I'm so sorry it's come to this. We do what we've always done. Feed you stories so you won't be compromised, so you won't compromise us when someone catches you and starts poking your amygdala. But the switch was for your protection. We don't know who we're up against. We don't know how many hives are out there, what stage of gestation any of them have reached, how many may have already matured. All we know is that a handful of unarmed children can slaughter our most elite forces at will. And we are so very unready for the world to know that. But you know, Sergeant, you dropped out of the game, which may well have cost us the mission, and now you know things that are way above your clearance. Tell me, if our positions were reversed, what would you do?
Asante closes his eyes. We should be dead. Every one of these moments is a gift. When he opens them again, Rossiter's watching, impassive as ever.
I should have died up there. I should have died off Takoradi 2 years ago.
The major snorts. Don't be melodramatic, Sergeant. We're not going to execute you.
What?
We're not even going to court-martial you.
Why the hell not?
And at her raised eyebrow.
Sir? You said it yourself. Unauthorized dropout, middle of combat situation.
We're not entirely certain that was your decision.
It felt like my decision.
It always does, though, doesn't it? Rossiter pushes back in her chair. We didn't create your evil twin, Sergeant. We didn't even put it in control. We just got you out of the way so it could do what it always does without interference. Only now, it apparently wants you back.
This takes a moment to sink in.
What?
Frontoparietal log suggests your zombie took a certain initiative, decided to quit.
In combat? That would be suicide.
Isn't that what you wanted? He looks away.
No? Don't like that hypothesis?
Well, here's another. It surrendered. Moore got you out, after all, which was statistically unlikely the way things were going. Maybe dropping out was a white flag, and the hive took pity and let you go so you could, I don't know, spread the word, don't fuck with us. Or maybe it decided the hive deserved to win and switched sides. Maybe it was conscientiously objecting. Maybe it decided it never enlisted in the first place.
Asante decides he doesn't like the sound of the major's laugh.
You must have asked it, he says.
A dozen different ways. Zombies might be analytically brilliant, but they're terrible at self-reflection. They can tell you exactly what they did, but not necessarily why.
When did you ever care about motive?
His tone verges on insubordination. He's too empty to care.
Just tell it to stay in control. It has to obey you, right? That orbital frontal thing. The compliance mod?
Absolutely. But it wasn't your twin who dropped out. It was you when it unleashed the mandala.
So order it not to show me the mandala.
We'd love to. I don't suppose you'd care to tell us what it looks like?
It's Asante's turn to laugh. He sucks at it.
I didn't think so, not that it matters. At this point, we can't trust you either. Again, not entirely your fault. Given the degree to which conscious and unconscious processes are interconnected, it may have been premature to try and separate them so completely right off the bat.
She winces, as if in sympathy.
I can't imagine it's much fun for you either, being cooped up in that skull with nothing to do.
Maddox said there was no way around it.
That was true when he said it.
Eyes downcast now, sacking the omnipresent pad. We weren't planning on-field testing the new mod just yet, but with Kalmus and now you, I don't see much choice but to advance implementation by a couple of months. He never felt more dead inside, even when he was.
Haven't you stuck enough pins in us?
By which he means me, of course, by process of elimination. For a moment, the Major almost seems sympathetic.
Yes, Kojo. Just one last modification. I don't think you'll even mind this one, because next time you wake up, you'll be a free man. Your tour will be over.
Really?
Really.
Asante looks down, frowns.
What is it, Sergeant?
Nothing,
he says, and regards his steady, unwavering left hand with distant wonder. Lazarus. Renata Behrman comes back screaming. She's staring at the ceiling, pinned under something. The freezer, that's it. Big industrial thing. She was in the kitchen when the bombs hit. It must have fallen. She thinks it's crushed her legs. The fighting seems to be over. She hears no small arms fire, no whistle of incoming ordnance. The air's still filled with screams, but they're just gulls come to feast in the aftermath. She's lucky she was inside. Those vicious little air rats would have pecked her eyes out by now if she'd been blackness.
Oh, dear. Where am I? Oh, right.
Bleeding out at the bottom of the Americas after... She doesn't know. Maybe this was payback for the annexation of Tierra del Fuego. Or maybe it's the lifeguards, wreaking vengeance on all those who'd skipped town after trampling the world to mud and shit. This is a staging area, after all, a place where human refuse congregates until the pressure builds once again, and another bolus gets shat across the Drake Passage to the land of milk and honey and melting glaciers, the sphincter of the Americas. She wonders when she got so cynical. Not very seemly for a humanitarian. She coughs, tastes blood. Footsteps crunch on the gravel outside, quick, confident, not the shell-shocked stumble you'd expect from anyone who's just experienced apocalypse. She fumbles for her gun. A cheap microwave thing, barely boils water, but it helps level the field when a 50-kilogram woman has to lay down the law to a man with twice the mass and 10 times the entitlement issues. Better than nothing. Or it would be, if it was still in its holster. If it hadn't somehow skidded up against a table leg 1.5 meters to her left. She stretches for it, screams again, feels like she's just torn herself in half as the kitchen door slams open and she blacks out, and comes back with the gun miraculously in her hand, her finger pumping madly against the stud, mosquito buzz snap filling her ears, and she's racked, coughing blood, too weak to keep firing even if the man in the West Ham uniform hadn't just taken her gun away. He looks down at her from a great height. His voice echoes from the bottom of a well. He doesn't seem to be speaking to her.
Behind the mess hall. English. Fatal injuries. Maybe 15 minutes left in her, and she's still fighting.
When she wakes up again, the pain's gone and her vision's blurry. The man has changed from white to black. Or maybe it's a different man. Hard to tell through all these floaters.
Renata Behrman.
His voice sounds strangely unused somehow, as if he were trying it out for the first time. There's something else about him. She squints, forces her eyes to focus. The lines of his uniform resolve in small, painful increments. No insignia. She moves her gaze to his face.
Coño,
she manages at last. Her voice is barely a whisper. She sounds like a ghost,
What's wrong with your eyes?
Renata Bellman,
he says again.
Have I got a deal for you?